Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group and Regulatory Transparency Project, was recorded on Monday, April 15, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is Race in Admissions, Texas Tech Medical School. My name is Michael Wallen, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Roger Clegg, who is General Counsel for the Center for Equal Opportunity. After our speaker gives his remarks, we will then go to audience Q&A. Thank you for sharing with us today. Roger, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Micah, and thank you for setting this up so quickly. This is, I think, prompted by a news story that the Wall Street Journal broke less than a week ago. So it shows the lightning speed and efficiency of the Federalist Society. What I'd like to do in my opening remarks here is briefly give sort of an introduction and overview, and then talk about, first of all, the facts of the Texas Tech matter, and then talk briefly about what this says about the Trump administration, and then some about the legal implications. So that's the basic roadmap. And the other thing that I want to make sure that I give some attention to, which is kind of woven through this discussion, is going to be what this tells us about the procedures at the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights when they deal with complaints. The subtext and sometimes the overt text is going to be that I think conservatives should be alert to the opportunity that they have to file complaints with the Office for Civil Rights. And it's often a very valuable tool. And the facts of this case, I think, illustrate why that is the case. Okay, well, so what happened? A resolution agreement was reached between the Trump administration, the Office for Civil Rights at the Education, and Texas Tech Medical School recently, in which the school agreed to stop using racial preferences in their admissions. This is a big deal. Of course, lots of selective schools use racial preferences, and in particular, lots of medical schools use racial preferences. And it's important that Texas Tech stopped. The reason that this came about was that my organization, the Center for Equal Opportunity, a long time ago, in 2004, filed a complaint against Texas Tech University in which we complained about their use of racial preferences. Obviously, this had a long gestation period, but eventually what we got out of it was a resolution not only that the medical school would stop giving it, but the other parts of Texas Tech that were investigated, undergraduate admissions and other schools in the health science area like pharmacy and so forth and nursing also are not using racial preferences. The reason that we chose to file a complaint against Texas Tech in 2004 was that it presented an unusual situation. The Fifth Circuit had ruled in the 1990s that the desire to have a diverse student body was not a compelling interest under the Equal Protection Clause. At the time, the Supreme Court, of course, had not adopted Justice Powell's opinion in the Bakke case, which was decided in 1978. Justice Powell wrote just for himself in saying that he thought that diversity was a compelling interest. No other justice joined him. A lot of schools seized upon this and were using racial preferences. But the Fifth Circuit, in a case called Hopwood, decided that no, that was not right, that it was not a compelling interest. And so the law in the Fifth Circuit from the 1990s until the University of Michigan decisions were decided by the Supreme Court in 2003 was that you couldn't, was basically the answer, you could not use racial preferences in admissions. The Supreme Court, as I just said, ruled in 2003, however, that no, Justice Powell was actually correct and that diversity was a compelling interest. And immediately after that, Texas Tech said that, oh, great, this is a wonderful decision, and we're going to start using racial preferences again. What we decided at the Center for Equal Opportunity was that even if it was true that diversity was a compelling interest, and of course we didn't, you know, like the Supreme Court's decision, but you know, even if taking that as true, one of the elements of narrow tailoring under the Supreme Court's decision was that schools use race only as a last resort, you know, that they have considered race-neutral alternatives to achieving a diverse student body before adopting racial preferences. And our argument was that, and the complaint that we filed with the Education Department, was that that element of narrow tailoring was not met because not only had Texas Tech tried a race-neutral alternative to racial preferences, but it had worked. And we had the figures to show that the degree of diversity at Texas Tech was actually, you know, better than it was in the University of Michigan cases. And of course, one of them had been upheld, one had been struck down. But in any event, we said that, you know, look, there was, you know, they had as much diversity as University of Michigan had. University of Michigan thought that that was enough. And so therefore, it should have been enough for, you know, for Texas Tech as well. The reason, by the way, that, or one of the reasons that Texas Tech University undergraduate admissions might have succeeded in having a degree of diversity was that, as some of you may recall, Texas public universities, after the Hopwood decision, adopted this so-called top 10% plan, where if you graduated in the top 10% of your public high school graduating class in Texas, you could go to any university you like. And this had the result of increasing the amount of student body, you know, diversity. So we filed this complaint with the Education Department, and this was under Bush 43. And again, it took a long time, you know, for anything to happen. But finally, you know, last year we began to you know, get phone calls from the Education Department. First of all, the undergraduate admissions people decided that turns out that, you know, they said that they weren't using racial preferences anymore. And then as part of their investigation, the OCR was looking at the health sciences schools, and they all said one by one that either they weren't using racial preferences, or that they would stop, or had stopped, though they'd used them before. And then finally, you know, the last domino to fall was in February, the medical school, which had been using racial preferences, said that it would not anymore. And yeah, it signed this resolution agreement. And by the way, all the relevant documents are on our website, which is ceousa.org, including this two-page resolution agreement. But, you know, what they said was that they were going to stop using racial preferences as of March 1st, and that if they ever wanted to start using them again, they would have to get permission from the Education Department, and they would have to show that their use of racial preferences was narrowly tailored. After we learned of this, we decided that, well, this is good news, and this is something that schools should know about. And so we shared the story with the media, starting with the Wall Street Journal, and then with other media as well. It was not a story that was initially publicized, you know, by the Education Department. You know, it's sort of interesting that I'll be talking more about this, but the basic approach of the Office for Civil Rights under the leadership of Ken Marcus, who's the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Education Department, is that this is not supposed to be a political operation. It's not supposed to be it's a law enforcement matter, and that means, you know, you don't have lots of press releases and things like that. You know, you receive complaints and you look at them and decide if there's something that should be investigated, and then you investigate them and you resolve them, and, you know, you go on to the next complaint. The takeaway from this is, I think, twofold, maybe threefold. The first thing that it shows is that the Trump administration is going to take seriously its responsibility to enforce the civil rights laws in a way that protect all Americans from discrimination. It's not going to turn a blind eye to politically correct discrimination the way the Obama administration did. So that's, obviously good news. This is not the first time, I should say, that the Office for Civil Rights, or that the Trump administration has done the right thing in this area. The Justice Department, for example, is investigating Harvard and Yale for its undergraduate admissions discrimination, particularly against Asian Americans. It filed a statement of interest in the Harvard case, supporting the claim by Asian Americans there of discrimination by Harvard. Another example is the skepticism that the Trump administration has shown toward the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement, which is, I view as a species of racial preferences. It certainly encourages race-based decision-making and encourages the use of racial preferences and quotas. And the Trump administration has withdrawn guidance by OCR and by the Justice Department that used a very aggressive kind of disparate impact enforcement in the school discipline area. It also withdrew guidance about affirmative action specifically. They've shown skepticism as well. They're reevaluating the disparate impact regulations in the housing area and so forth. I should say that the one area where I think conservatives have some concern is with the Department of Labor. My own view is that the regulations that have been promulgated by the Labor Department for the enforcement of Executive Order 11246, which has to do with federal contracting, are long overdue for an overhaul, because they require that goals and timetables be set when employers have, quote, underrepresentation, end quote, of, quote, women and minorities, end quote. And I think that there are real constitutional and statutory problems with that. And I'm hopeful that the Trump administration will, that the Labor Department will act on that, sooner rather than later as well. The bottom line with respect to the Trump administration is that it's doing a good job in this area, and that in particular this action with respect to Texas Tech Medical School is more evidence of that. With respect to the law, I think that the more schools that stop using racial preferences in admissions, the more difficult it is for the remaining schools to claim that their use of racial preferences is constitutional and consistent with the civil rights laws. And that's because, as I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has made clear that race is not supposed to be used except as a last resort. And if you have schools all over the country that are not using racial preferences and are thriving, then what's the argument that a remaining school has to use racial preferences in order to operate? To give an example, racial preferences are not used at public universities in California, Washington, Arizona, Nebraska, in Michigan, and Oklahoma. If the medical schools in California and Washington aren't using racial preferences, then why do the public medical schools in Oregon have to use them? And if racial preferences aren't being used now at medical schools in West Texas, which is where Texas Tech is, or Oklahoma, or Arizona, then why do Colorado and Arizona and New Mexico have to use racial preferences? And if they're not being used in Nebraska and Michigan, then why do they have to be used in, Wisconsin and Iowa and so forth? So I think that this is an important point, and so that decisions like the one that was reached at Texas Tech help to advance the ball, more broadly. I want to say just a few words about the complaint process at the Office for Civil Rights at the Education Department, because I think it's a process that a lot of people may not be familiar with, and I think it's one that is potentially useful, in particular for conservatives to be aware of and to use. Basically the way that it works is that there's not a standing requirement in the sense that you have to file a lawsuit. If someone is aware that discrimination is ongoing in a particular instance, that person can simply send a letter to the education department describing the discrimination and asking that it be investigated. And when that happens, the education department's Office for Civil Rights will look at it, make an initial determination of whether what's being alleged would, if true, be a violation, and that the institution doing the discrimination is covered by the laws that CR enforces, and then begin an investigation. And of course, with respect to universities, if you get federal money, then Title VI of the Civil Rights Act prohibits you from engaging in racial discrimination except in narrow circumstances. And so OCR has jurisdiction, and all universities in the United States get federal money except, I think, for two, Hillsdale and Grove City. My understanding is that the education department prefers if you can point to people who are aggrieved by the discrimination. I think that helps them sort of prioritize and which complaints to investigate first, and it also is useful evidence if they want to start interviewing people to find out exactly how the discrimination is occurring. But I don't think it's an ironclad requirement. So the investigation begins. Of course, this is something of a black box. I don't know exactly, and I think that the people who file the complaints don't know exactly how things are proceeding. Typically, OCR will contact the university. After they've gotten all the information they can get from the complainant, they will then contact the university, and a long time can go by without the complainant hearing anything else about what's going on. And sometimes you win these cases and sometimes not. I mean, I think that what happened in Texas is actually illustrative of that. At the same time that we filed a complaint against Texas Tech, we also filed a complaint against the University of Texas and against Rice University. Of course, we won ultimately against Texas Tech. It took a long time, but we did win. Against the University of Texas, what happened was that eventually, of course, the University of Texas was sued for this discrimination, and therefore our case was closed. I think that the view of the Education Department is that, well, if a matter is being decided in court, we don't need to proceed administratively. That was the end of that complaint. And then in the other instance, the OCR decided under the Obama administration that actually the use of racial preferences was okay. So you don't always win, but of course it's also you can have two bites at the apple. If you file a complaint with OCR and a long time goes by or you think that it's not headed in the right direction or you even lose, you can always file a lawsuit then. You're not precluded from filing a lawsuit and proceed that way. You didn't mention just two other things about the situation at the Office for Civil Rights right now. I mentioned that the head of the office is Ken Marcus. Ken Marcus is a solid conservative, a very fine lawyer, smart guy, knows this area very well, and he has written in particular about the importance of narrow tailoring requirements and the importance that they be met before racial preferences are used. So I think that the failure of a university that's using racial preferences to consider race neutral alternatives, for example, is one that he's particularly interested in, and that's sort of indicated by the resolution agreement that was reached in this case. But it is possible as well to, you know, to prevail on the first prong of strict scrutiny. Another complaint that we filed that was, you know, almost as long in getting resolved was against the state of Kentucky's education department, which had a program that used racial preferences in awarding, you know, financial aid to people who wanted to become, you know, teachers. And, you know, the idea was that it would be a good thing if there were more teachers of a particular color rather than the disfavored colors in Kentucky, and that therefore they were going to fund students who were the right color and not those who were the wrong color. That complaint was also resolved favorably for us under the Trump administration, and there the failure that was adduced was one that you know, there was really no compelling interest, that, you know, indeed the Supreme Court has rejected the role model justification in the Wygant case, and that justification had been one of the things that had been put forward by Kentucky, and that the, you know, remedial justification that had been offered you know, was not a plausible one in this context either. So, you know, therefore the use of racial preferences there failed because of a failure to identify a compelling interest. You know, I would encourage people who out there who are aware of discrimination and have, you know, good evidence that it's occurring, be alert to the possibility of filing complaints with the Office for Civil Rights at the Education Department. I think that they are quite interested in getting complaints, and I think that they will handle them well. You know, obviously, as I said before, it's better, you know, if you can identify aggrieved people, but I don't think that that's you know, necessarily required. You know, particularly if the discrimination, you know, can be identified, you know, through public actions or pronouncements or, you know, statements by the universities. You know, because of the fact that the people who run universities tend to be politically correct to the nth degree and are very proud of their politically correct discrimination, it's often the case that they make unguarded remarks that would probably cause their general counsel to wince. And when those remarks are made and discriminatory programs are launched or are underway, I think that you know, filing a complaint with the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights is a good thing to keep in mind. With that, Micah, I'm going to stop talking. If you want to ask people out there in teleconference land to call in with questions or comments, I'd love to field them.
Not seeing any questions jump through the queue right away. Roger, I'll ask you, why do you think it took so long for OCR to process the complaint in the first place?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. I think that part of the answer may be, and I'm speculating, because as I say, it's something of a black box. But, you know, one suspects that the complaint was viewed very differently under the Obama administration than it was under Bush 43 and under Trump. And it may have been the case that, you know, things were going along, you know, fairly aggressively under Bush 43. But that, you know, once that stopped, and, you know, you had different people who were at the head of OCR, some might have been more interested in this case than others, I don't know. But that, in any event, once the Obama administration came in, there was, you know, decidedly less interest. I think it's significant, though, that, you know, even under the Obama administration, you know, this complaint was not dismissed, which I think is evidence that, you know, there really was a problem, you know, with the way Texas Tech was operating. My sense of the way these complaints are processed is that, you know, it's not just a matter of fact finding, you know, by the Office for Civil Rights, that in addition, where they see that there's a problem or a potential problem, they start to lean on the universities, you know, to one extent. And, you know, if they're getting answers that suggest that there's a problem, they start to say, well, you know, do you really think that you have to use race, you know, in order to, you know, to award these scholarships, for example, or you know, to run your medical school. I mean, have you really looked at this? I mean, this is, you know, looks very shaky to us. And rather than lose your federal money, you know, of course, which is the ultimate, you know, hammer here, I think it might be, you know, useful for us to try to, you know, to work things out. Again, I don't know for sure that that's what happens, but I definitely have the impression that this is not just a matter of you know, collecting the facts without any kind of back and forth about whether what they're finding is problematic or not. And I say that because, you know, with a lot of the complaints that we've filed, you know, it's, you know, the resolution is that, you know, you have these voluntary agreements that are reached where the school either agrees to stop using race, or they say that, well, you know, actually, you know, we may have said that race was being considered, but we didn't really, mean it, or it actually wasn't being used quite as, you know, ham-handedly as we said. You know, we may have said that the scholarship was only for African Americans, but in fact, you know, we'd be happy to consider, you know, other people too. All of which is to say that, you know, the process can, you know, these are reasons why the process might have taken a while. Because, you know, ultimately, you know, as I said in my outline of the facts, you know, not only did, you know, the final outcome was not just that the medical school entered this resolution agreement, you know, in February, last February, but that Texas Tech University, you know, had been using racial preferences, but then they stopped. The I think the pharmacy school had been using racial preferences, but then they stopped. And the other schools in the health science department said that, well, actually, you know, we're not using racial preferences. So that's a long answer to your question, Micah. But I think that you know, the reason it took so long is because, you know, there were things going there. You know, there's a political explanation that, you know, these different administrations sort of look at this differently, but also that, you know, what's going on here is, you know, a little more complicated process than just, you know, a quick collection of facts and then a determination. I think there's a lot of back and forth that goes on as well.
All right. Thank you, Roger. And we did have two questions come through. Without further ado, we will now go to our first question.
My question is kind of more of a general one, and that is, why have we focused so much on racial preferences, whatever racial means, and not ever looked or barely looked? I guess now Harvard is being forced to because of our Asian students, but, you know, you also have, I happen to live in an area where there's a large number of people from the Middle East. And it would seem to me that if you're going to have a diverse population, it would probably, one could argue, that there ought to be a large number of people with a Middle Eastern background or family background that also ought to be at Texas Tech. And, of course, you do have people from Mexico and other South American countries. And so I just find it hard that even that this diversity focuses on one race, and it doesn't kind of include a number of other groups that perhaps also may add to the diversity of one's college or medical school life. It just seems very odd to me.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question, and that's an interesting question. And I'm going to divide, I guess, my answer into two parts. I think that with respect to, I mean, let me start by saying that the law that the Office for Civil Rights enforces here, Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, you know, forbids discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin. So, if you, I mean, for example, let's take religion. You know, I think that having people from diverse religious backgrounds, you know, certainly can add, you know, the kind of diversity of perspectives and experiences and so forth that you know, that if, you know, if you, you know, believe in you know, the value of diversity, that's, you know, one kind of diversity that ought to be taken into account. Or diversity in, you know, simple, you know, geographic background, you know, people from Montana and Ohio versus, you know, Texas and Florida, you know, differences in socioeconomic background. All of those, I think, are important, you know, kinds of diversity. But giving preferential treatment or weighing that doesn't raise any legal issue. You know, there's nothing illegal about giving a preference to people from Ohio over people from Alaska, or even in terms of, you know, the Title VI, you know, there's nothing that says that there's anything, you know, illegal about preference on the basis of you know, religion. And of course, nothing illegal about preference on the basis of socioeconomic background. So, I mean, you know, my first answer to you is that some kinds of diversity discrimination are not of interest to the enforcement people in the federal government because they don't raise any you know, legal issues. But with respect to you know, the kinds of, you know, racial and ethnic discrimination, I do think that those kinds of diversity, you know, for good or ill, are looked at by universities, you know, to some extent. They do raise legal problems, and you know, as your question, you know, indicated, it's not just, you know, whites, you know, who are frequently discriminated against by politically correct discrimination. You know, frequently, Asian Americans are discriminated against, you know, in favor of African Americans and Latinos. And Latinos, by the way, you know, I think is, you know, not a, you know, a racial category. It's really an ethnic or national origin, you know, category. But it's certainly true that, you know, some groups are of interest to universities to, you know, to increase their numbers, and other groups aren't. And I think that, you know, that's, you know, the nature of the politically correct ideology, you know, that's in place here. You know, they, universities are not, you know, interested in the diversity that might be provided by a particular white or Asian American applicant. You know, they want to get their numbers right, or, you know, what they consider to be right with respect to so-called underrepresented minorities, you know, which, you know, typically African Americans and Latinos, and to some extent sometimes American Indians. It's a good question, and thank you for asking it.
And we will now go to our next question.
Hi, Roger. It's Ken Masugi. Thank you again for all the good work you've been doing, especially recently on Asian American admissions at Harvard. I have a question based on what you just said. And I wonder, let's say Texas Tech thinks it has an obligation to try to raise the condition of Black Americans in Texas. And so it decides to have a program in which they don't practice what we conventionally call affirmative action, but rather they have sort of outreach programs that encourage African American students to apply. And they target in particular areas in which there might be African Americans. They might target not just public schools, but private schools. And given your standard of colorblindness, would such outreach programs violate the Constitution?
Well, thank you, Ken. That's a great question. And I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that Ken's lovely wife, Althea Nagai, is the author of some of the Center for Equal Opportunity papers that have been you know, released recently on Asian American discrimination. And Althea does great work, and I have great affection and respect for, you know, for Ken as well. You know, my view is that if a university decides that it wants to get more people of one race, and that it's going to start, you know, fiddling around with its recruiting and admission requirements in order to, you know, increase, you know, the numbers of one race, that is a constitutional problem. You know, we're dealing here, you know, obviously with a zero-sum game. You know, if you're trying to increase your numbers of one race, then that means that, you know, you're trying to keep down the numbers of other races. And I think that, you know, you can see the problems in this area. I think it's always useful, you know, to put the shoe on the other foot and ask, well, you know, what if this were being done, you know, in the bad old days? And, you know, Ole Miss said that, well, you know, we want to keep out African Americans to the extent that we can, and we know that we can't just say that you're not allowed to apply or you're not going to get in if you're African American, but we are going to change our recruiting policies so that they are friendlier toward white students. You know, we're going to recruit only at all white schools, and we're going to send our letters encouraging people to apply only to zip codes that you know, tend to be white, and you know, we're going to look at sports that tend to be dominated by whites, and we're going to start, you know, decreasing the weight that we give to admissions criteria that we used to look at, but we're not going to look at anymore because they seem to be ones that are giving us too many black students. I think everybody would, you know, immediately agree that, well, you know, that's a problem. You know, Ole Miss couldn't do that, and I think by the same token, it's certainly, you know, racial discrimination. I mean, it's like a grandfather clause. If you deliberately engage in selection practice, if you choose your selection practices, or you engage in recruiting in a way that's sort of aimed at some racial groups and you know, trying to avoid other racial groups, that's a problem. You know, a grandfather clause may not be discriminatory on its face, but you know, it certainly is intended to, you know, to keep out you know, to keep African Americans from voting. And so, you know, the Supreme Court said that you can't do that. Now, the Supreme Court has also said, though, that in this area of university admissions, that achieving, you know, the educational benefits of diversity is a compelling interest, and that it is okay for the consideration of race to be something that can be done, you know, that can be engaged in order to achieve those educational benefits. But they've also said that the use of race has to be narrowly tailored, and that means that it's better to use indirect and race-neutral methods to achieve a racial result than to use simple overt, you know, preferences. So that for purposes of the narrow tailoring prong, it does matter, you know, even if you're being motivated by race, it's better, you know, to engage in the kind of, you know, facially neutral, you know, kinds of discrimination than kinds that are overtly discriminatory. So, for example, you know, if Texas Tech, you know, or some, you know, some other school said that, well, you know, look, we want to have racial diversity, and you know, we can choose, you know, a couple ways to do it. You know, one is, you know, we're just going to have preferences for black, but the other is that, or let's take Latinos, because that's, I think, you know, gives rise to a better example. You know, one is that we can just give a preference to Latinos. But the other is that we can start, you know, considering somebody's facility with more than one language. You know, there actually are some reasons why, you know, having facility with more than one language, you know, makes some sense. You know, it's nice if doctors, you know, can speak to patients, you know, who speak, you know, who may not speak English. It will improve, you know, our numbers for Latinos, but it's not as discriminatory. It's not as you know, as simply giving a preference to Latinos. I think that, you know, the law would be that, well, that's more narrowly tailored. And I think that the education department would say that, yeah, you know, if you have the choice between those two, then the law requires you to engage in the, you know, the less discriminatory, you know, the facially race neutral alternative. Very long answer to your excellent question, Ken. You have to make a distinction between whether you're talking about whether strict scrutiny is triggered on the one hand, where I think that, you know, the facial neutrality doesn't save you if the motive, you know, is discriminatory, but that whether or not a policy is narrowly tailored or not, it does matter whether you're talking about something that may be racially motivated, but there seems to, you know, the court's case law seems to indicate that it's better to do it in a way that, you know, is usually using a facially neutral approach.
All right. We now have three questions in the queue. So without further ado, we'll move to the next question.
This is another Ken. Are there any cases or any regulations that discuss what it in fact means to be African American? Like, what percent do you have to be? I know there's percentages and all that with American Indians, but like, what is somebody who's black? I mean, Latino? I mean, what does that mean? I mean, if one of your parents is or is not, that's 50-50, obviously. I mean, what percent do you get down to?
Another great question. Ken II, thank you for that. I'm not aware of any American, U.S. regulations that specify that. I think that, sometimes you do have to, supply evidence, supporting, your claim to be of this or that race. But, I'm not aware of anything that has the kind of specificity that you were talking about. And I think that, when you think about it, it's obvious why. Justice Kennedy, in a opinion that he wrote in a case called Metro Broadcasting, and Justice Stevens in another contracting case called Fuller Love versus Klutznick, both of whom were writing against the use of racial preferences, pointed out that, rather sardonically, that, if you're going to be serious about this, then you're going to have to define, who the members of these different groups are, and you're going to need to start looking at statutes like the ones that Nazi Germany had and like the ones that South Africa had. And they did have the kind of specificity, that you're talking about, whereas, you're considered a Jew, if you have, a grandparent, who is Jewish, but a great grandparent is not enough, or, that kind of nonsense. And I think that, once the government started to do that, it would become, quite offensive and quite, obvious what the, how ugly this kind of discrimination is. So, my answer is that I don't think that that's done in any, American, statutes that I'm, aware of. And I think that, one reason for that is actually why this whole business of giving preferential treatment is, ultimately even more untenable in a country that's becoming more and more multi-ethnic, more and more multiracial, and where individual Americans are more and more likely to be multiracial and multi-ethnic. If we start asking people questions like that and, requiring DNA tests and so forth to decide, how the government is going to treat you, the offensiveness of this whole enterprise becomes, even more apparent than it already is.
All right, we'll now go to our next question.
In answer to the last question, there are no standards in the Civil Rights Acts about who's what race. You can be any race you say you are. Just ask Pocahontas. But the fact that you mentioned it being a zero-sum game, isn't the reason that it's a zero-sum game because the American Medical Association has artificially limited the number of people who can graduate from medical schools, from certified medical schools, and taken control of licensing in all states, as Ron Paul said years ago, and thereby artificially made it a zero-sum game that can't be expanded and kept the price of medicine high by those licensing rules. By the way, I'm Chris Garvey. I'm the last Libertarian candidate for Attorney General in 2018.
Well, very good. Well, thank you for your question, Chris. Well, it's certainly true that the restrictions placed on who can practice medicine make the slots that are being fought over, even more dear than they would otherwise be. I think, though, that, for individual schools, it would still be a zero-sum game. That is, even if the law were somehow changed and anybody could practice medicine, there would still be only a certain number of slots that, were available to Harvard Medical School or to Texas Tech Medical School. So it would remain a zero-sum game in that respect, even though, for society generally, there's, the number of people who could
who could practice medicine would be not as limited.
I'll take your question, though, to make a related point that I think is worth making, which is that, you know, as disturbing as the use of racial preferences is, you know, when we're talking about, you know, who gets into, you know, this or that undergraduate institution, and, you know, after all, you know, there pretty much is the case that anybody who wants to go, you know, to college can. I mean, there you know, there will be a university or college someplace that will take them, since a lot of them are basically open admissions. It does seem especially ugly and disturbing when, you know, we are using non-meritocratic standards to determine who's going to be practicing in an area where there are, you know, literally life and death responsibilities. You know, we are saying that we are more interested in having a politically correct array of doctors than having the best qualified individuals who can be doctors, even if this results in the quality of doctors going down, and inevitably with the kind of medical care that people get going down. And that means more people die. So I think that, you know, when you start using racial preferences in this particular context, it's, you know, again, it sort of underscores the ugliness and the unacceptability of this whole enterprise.
We'll now go to our last question.
Yes, hello, Roger. Thank you for hosting this call. I have one comment and one question. The question earlier about whether or not it would be a problem legally with targeted recruiting, rings very similar to the Griggs versus Duke Power case. It's not exact, but you're really talking like a disparate impact and its effect, even though there's a underlying purposeful intent to discriminate. So I guess with that precedent, it probably the targeted recruiting could be a problem, at least as far as precedent. I have to think that the Griggs versus Duke Power Company case was incorrectly decided, but I'm probably in the minority there. My feeling is that as long as it's facially neutral to policy, whatever the effect is, even if the effect is somewhat even if the purpose is improper, I think you have to sort of just let it go. So I personally wouldn't, legal constitutional matter, I think targeted recruiting wouldn't be a problem. You can comment on that if you like, but I want to ask one other question. Since the Texas Tech has made this decision to eliminate this racial preference policy, has there been any uproar about this as far as civil rights groups, you know, National Urban League or whoever, just saying, you know, creating a problem? I haven't heard anything on the news about this, but I was just wondering if this is it's really caught on, and there's been like a lot of pushback as a result.
Well, thanks very much. You know, for both your comment and your question, and I'll do your question first. You know, there was a lot of media, a lot of news stories about this, and I think that, you know, there are plenty of people in the civil rights establishment out there that use this as an opportunity to, you know, attack the Trump administration and to say that, you know, this is a bad thing, that use of racial preferences is wonderful, and, you know, anything that suggests that there's going to be less use of racial preferences is a bad thing. And so they, you know, they condemned the, you know, the resolution agreement. On your comment, I also think that Griggs was wrongly decided, but I also think that there's a big difference between using a facially neutral criterion, a selection criterion, without an intent to discriminate against some groups and other groups, versus using a facially neutral criterion with that intent. And I don't like the disparate impact approach. I don't like the decision in Griggs. But remember what was going on there, and what's going on in the context of a disparate impact lawsuit is not just something where, you know, the employer thinks that, for example, you know, requiring a high school diploma, not just where the employer has chosen a criterion that is neutral on its face, but where his intent was not to give an advantage or a disadvantage to any racial or ethnic group. You know, the intent was not discriminatory. You know, they,
employer just thought that, well, you know, it's a good way to sort of, you know, sort of do a rough cut of kinds of employees who, you know, might work out here. And, you know, it's not perfect, but, you know, if you have a high school diploma, it shows that, you know, you have a certain degree of, you know, self-discipline and education. And, you know, that's what I want. That's different than, you know, somebody who says that, well, you know, look, I know that there are a lot fewer blacks, you know, in my neck of the woods who have high school diplomas than whites. And so even though I don't really, you know, I'm hiring, you know, ditch diggers, and it doesn't really make any difference whether they have a high school diploma or not, this is a great way to hire more whites and fewer blacks. And so that's why I'm going to adopt it. You know, if you are adopting a selection criterion that may be neutral on its face, but you're doing it with discriminatory motive, you know, that is not a disparate impact violation. You know, that is disparate treatment. You know, that is intentional discrimination. And, you know, the Supreme Court in cases like Arlington Heights, you know, has said that, you know, the Constitution forbids only, you know, disparate treatment, but if you choose a neutral criterion, like a grandfather clause, you know, again, because you want to hurt or, you know, you want to, you know, target a particular racial group, that's not disparate impact. That's disparate treatment.
All right. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.